Hello, everyone, and welcome to WNPA Podcasts. This is a series of interviews where accomplished journalists share ideas about how they approach researching, interviewing, and writing stories. The hope is that you might try some of these techniques and push your journalism to a higher level. Writing stories that matter, that change the conversation, that shape the times we live in, that ultimately is our goal. And the ability to do that is what separates exceptional journalists from ordinary ones. Now here's our interviewer, Mike Dillon.
Welcome, everybody. Mike Dillon here, retired publisher and former WNPA board member, coming to you from WNPA headquarters in downtown Port Townsend. Our guest today is Jackie Bonaczynski, who, among other notable things, has won the Pulitzer Prize in 1988 for feature writing while at the St. Paul Pioneer Press for her three-part series, AIDS in the Heartland. And I'll tell you, I think it's one of the most beautifully rendered and powerful stories I've ever read.
Thank you.
And I'm almost 70, and I've been around the block a few times. And it's on her website.
That means you remember what that time was like, right?
I do, very much.
It was an
alien kind of problem, mainly centered in San Francisco.
Right, and the press didn't know how to cover it. We weren't covering the gay community very well, and everybody was afraid of it, and you know, it was sort of underground for years. And so it was interesting. It was an interesting thing to sort of look back on and go, what did we know? What didn't we? What should we have known? It was a really interesting time.
It is. And there's even talk of divine retribution at the time. I mean, it was not.
Divine retribution. This is God's punishment for aberrant behavior. You know, it's tainted blood. Socially, culturally, morally, it was pretty ugly.
And you were also the Pulitzer finalist in 1986 for international reporting for coverage of the Ethiopian famine. Jackie has worked as an editor and reporter for more than 30 years, which includes a stint as managing editor at the Seattle Times. You're in Seattle today, is that right?
I'm actually up in the mountains in the North Cascades in Mazama.
Thank you for making time.
You bet.
A few more biographical things, and this is a bridge because I could go on, but Jackie is professor emerita at the Missouri School of Journalism. She teaches and travels nationally and internationally and is on the visiting faculty of the Poynter Institute and writes a weekly column for the Nieman Storyboard, which, among other things, explores the future of nonfiction storytelling, which is what we're going to talk about a lot today. Anything you want to add to that, Jackie?
No, except you forgot my favorite award ever.
I know. Let me guess. The AP Sports Editor's Deadline.
Yes.
Writing contest about the 1988 Summer Olympics. Shook up the boys' network a little, I reckon.
I did. Oh, my God. They were pissed. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So let's start at the beginning, if we may. What kind of kid were you growing up?
Oh, what an interesting question. I was the only daughter in a family of five children. So I had two older and two younger brothers. Very traditional, small town, Polish Catholic town. My father was very old world, male, athlete, all those things. My brothers all kind of went into engineering. And so I was the odd one out, not necessarily because I didn't or wouldn't have fit, but because there were no options at the time. And I know how that ended up leading to journalism, but the one thing when I was a kid, I was very aware of from the time I was very, very small, is I was always curious about everything. My father used to try to tell me when I was like little that if I just shut up and stopped asking questions for 15 minutes, he'd give me a quarter, which of course was a lot of money at the time, right? It was like a quarter, right? I never made any money. I never made a dime, right? But I was curious about everything. I used to play these what if games in my head. I was a voracious reader from the I don't remember not being able to read. And I think that's because I sat next to my two older brothers when they would do homework, and my mother and the teachers would let me go to school with my brothers and sit next to them during school. So I started to go, we didn't have a preschool, but I started to go go to school really young. And my mother was a reader. We didn't have money. We didn't have books in the house, but she was a reader. And so I just was really curious about the world. And I desperately, this is terrible to say, because it was a wonderful place to grow up. I really wanted to get out and see the world.
Right.
I really wanted to see the world. I was just, I was so interested in what was going on out there.
When did you know, I mean, when was journalism it for you? When did you know that was your call?
Well, that's an interesting question, Mike, because I don't really think I got comfortable with it until I was well into my 30s. But I started doing it when I was 14 or 15. My high school had a, you know, most non-traditional careers were not open to me. But my high school had a tremendous journalism program. To this day, it is the only journalism, high school journalism program in the country in which the high school journalism students cover the community as if it's you know, a local paper. We came out twice a month. And we did it all. We sold the ads and we went to the press and we went to all the meetings. And I started working on the paper when I was 15. And because I had an aptitude for it, and it was different than being a teacher or a nurse, I went to college in journalism and I just kept going. I don't think, though, I became comfortable with journalism. I think journalism's hard to get comfortable with. You know, you're constantly trying to figure out a new thing and not get it wrong.
Well, comfort, is, I not, think it, yeah, comfort pardon, is not part of the deal, is it? I mean, at first.
No. And you're asking strangers questions and you're, you know, my mother's, I grew up in a little tiny house. And so my mother's cardinal rules were to mind your own business. you know, don't be prying into other people's privacy. And of course, then I become a journalist, right? But I think I finally sort of became comfortable with trusting that I could do it well enough to not be miserable all the time. I was in my 30s. I was probably in my early to mid 30s.
And is that sort of when you found your writer's voice as well, that you knew that you could write well? Or is that different?
You know, that's a great question. If I look back on the stuff I did earlier, the voice was already there. I just didn't know it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in any kind of control of it, which means it was just there and sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't.
Right.
I think, no, and I you know, because I never prided myself on being a writer. I was always more invested in being a good reporter and a good news person. I think my comfort level came when I finally accepted that it was uncomfortable to report. And I usually did it well enough to do a credible, valuable job. The writing was just the rest of it. But to me, the comfort and the acceptance had to come through the reporting, not the writing.
But when I look at your Pulitzer Prize winner and other stories you've done, it's the writer's voice that's there. And it's strongly in command of a narrative. And I just wanted, you may be tired of talking about your story, Jackie, but I just want to quote from the opening to give our listeners a feeling for the way you write and the way you set the story up. Plus, I want to talk a little bit about it, if you don't mind, because there are things we can learn from it. But here's how it opens, and it's in italics. Death is no stranger to the heartland. It is as natural as the seasons, as inevitable as farm machinery breaking down and farmers' bodies giving out after too many years of too much work. But when death comes in the guise of AIDS, it is a disturbingly unfamiliar visitor, one better known in the gay districts and drug houses of the big cities, one that shows no respect for the usual order of life in the country. So you must have been facing some headwinds or crosswinds in terms of your readership and the subject matter. but you've done a couple of things there. You've clearly announced that they're going to be entering a story that's pretty compelling, and it's different, and you label the installments, there are three, as chapters. But you also are making clear that you're walking the same soil that your readers are. You're touching base with the world that they know, even though the illness is somewhat alien to them. And I just thought that was just masterful, and it's something that we can all take away from, I think, in our small communities or wherever we're reporting. Yeah, and that was obviously important to you, and to right off the bat.
Yeah, but I would like to say that that's about the reporting more than the writing, or at least as much as the writing, because we had so, Jean Pierre, the photographer who I partnered with, and I had so immersed ourselves in that world, and we knew from the beginning, which was like a full year and a half later, or earlier, that we wanted to follow somebody who was like everybody else in Minnesota or Wisconsin or the rural Midwest. And so we rejected a lot of people who could have been our subjects because they weren't the ordinary guy next door. And so once we found Dick and Bert, we really immersed ourselves in that world. And so part of it is I wanted to show their world. And part of it is I wanted to speak to a world that would understand that this really was about their next door neighbor. This wasn't about the guys in the big city, right? And so my favorite line from that opening, and thank you for reading that, is the one about farm machinery and farmers' bodies giving out.
Yeah.
My mother grew up on a farm, and her entire family were dairy farmers. So I grew up in a dairy farming area, and I watched that happen to people over and over and over again. And so part of this is just me kind of pulling in what I already know and I'm watching. It's like, that's a hard life. You're not sitting at a desk. You're hauling hay bales, and you're slopping out the manure in the barn, and you're working hard. You're hauling big, you know, my grandmother was tiny, used to haul these huge, huge 100-pound cans of milk out to the truck. And so that just comes from me saying, I want people to understand that this is about that life, because it was so easy for people then to say, no, it's the other. It's the other. And this was the other. These were two gay men, and they had AIDS and all that. But this was not the other entirely.
Right. Right.
And that comes from the reporting and from paying attention and say, what am I seeing? What do I know? And who am I talking to?
There's a tone to the story there, though, that almost is the sound of an elegy. I mean, that's the writer's voice to me.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And essentially, you followed a very sick man all the way to the grave, entered into his life and his partner's life. And his partner died, as I recall, 6 months later or so.
Yeah. And we did an epilogue. Yeah. So we did the three chapters that were the Pulitzer series.
Right.
And then we did an epilogue in April of the following year, which was actually ironically when the Pulitzers were announced. And I actually think the epilogue is the strongest piece of all of them. But it's not part of the Pulitzer series.
Right.
Yeah.
So in terms of a teaching moment for us, how did you gain their trust? And then generally, gaining people's trust to let you into their lives and keeping it? What can you tell us about that?
Right. Well, it's different if you're doing a long piece, you know, over time versus a piece on deadline. And I know that, you know, your members often are writing on really tight deadline. I think process is the same, but it's truncated or expanded. You have to be really honest and clear up front with what you're doing, why you're doing it, why you think it matters, how your process will work, and you need to be clear about fact checking and how you take notes and all that kind of stuff, and you can't ever break your promise. So in a short, you know, deadline story, you have to do that all in 30 seconds. Excuse me, Mr. Police Chief, this is a really important matter, and we need to be clear with our readers what's going on, and I expect you to serve the public. In this case, we spent hours and hours with the two men, because I thought I was just going to do a profile, not the whole narrative. And then when we realized, so they got to know us, and then when we realized we were going to go do the whole narrative, I spent an entire evening going through what that would mean, the process, the pros and cons. I told them they'd get death threats. I told them that they'd probably lose friends, maybe family members. I told them I couldn't promise anything good would happen, but I hoped it would. I told them that we had to have an ironclad agreement that we wouldn't bail out even if we didn't like part of it. I told them we would violate their privacy. I told them we'd be there when they wanted complete privacy. I told them that we would be asking questions that seemed way too personal. We put that all out there, and then I gave them a choice. And once they knew that and they made a choice and said, okay, then as the story went on and things got tough, because they did, we were able to go back to that agreement. But I think what most reporters miss is that they have to be really clear up front about saying, here's why I'm doing this and here's why it matters. And I'm going to stand by that. You have to believe in your work. And if I tell you we're going to fact check or do this or do that, I will keep my word.
And you talk sometimes about the importance of compassion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where did that come through in this process?
Well, professionally and logistically, it came through because even though we had this firm agreement that nothing was off the record, I let them express their concerns, and then I went and reported those out. And they had three conditions they wanted to impose, and I agreed to one and a half, or only one. No, one and a half. But only after I did the reporting on it. I think that compassion also showed when I said, okay, everything's on the record, but if my notebook is closed, if Gene's camera is shut, lens caps on, we'll still be paying attention. We can't not, but we won't hold you accountable for the specifics of what you said. We'll come back and ask about it later. If they said to me, as Bert did the night that Dick died, I need you to go away right now. I need to be alone with him. I would say, okay, but then we have an agreement that you will tell me everything that happened. So I tried to give them and let them have their own agency. I understood that other people around them had their own concerns about how they were reflected. Part of compassion, frankly, comes in letting people know how you're writing about them. So I don't show people copy, but letting people know, here's how I've cast you, here's how I've quoted you, here's what other people have said about you. So you're giving them a chance to be involved in the process. And I think that's part of compassion, is saying to people, I'm not going to exploit you for my own purposes.
Right. It strikes me too that there's some redeeming factor or some consolation for the reader. You've covered a lot of trauma, and mm-hmm. you've seen humanity at its best and at its worst. But mm-hmm. just the fact of bearing witness is cathartic. Mm-hmm. I get that from your stories. And I'm just going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to read something you filed from Turkey. And I can't pronounce the town. Kervin, could you pronounce that for me, Jackie? It's right after the 1991 war, and you're in the mountains between Turkey and Iraq.
Is it Isvrenik?
Isikveren. It's from the Pioneer Press, April 28th, 1991. Right. Anyway, I'll start with it. Here's your lead. To have your heart broken, it is not necessary to visit the children's hospital at the refugee camp called Isikveren. It is enough to walk up the mountain and look at all those small, watchful faces. It is enough even to look beyond the ones who are quiet, who stare but don't speak, and only count the ones who holler at your unguarded heart. Hello, hello, what is your name? The answer doesn't matter, only that you give one, and that you return their eager waves for as long as they wiggle and grin, until you are up the hill and around the corner and facing a new sea of tiny greeters. The census takers, such as they are, say 60% of the 2 million Kurds who fled Saddam Hussein's napalm and gas and Scud missiles are children. It's pretty powerful. And it's almost like you're a walking eyeball and we're with you and we're experiencing the emotions that you're experiencing. And that's part of the story, what you are experiencing.
Yeah, and I still go back to that one and wonder if I could have done something to write that lead without the second person, because the second person can come off as gimmicky. But there was no one else to interview. There was no one else that I could, so I wasn't going up that hill with some, you know, first-time American who was seeing what I was seeing. I did in that piece interview, you know, nurses and relief workers and things. But I think for this kind of work, we sometimes have to accept that we are the best source. We're the eyewitness, and then we have to own it. I didn't want to make it about I, but I was the one who was feeling this and seeing it. And I don't think it was a unique emotion. I think anybody who had been on that truck with me as we were going up that mountain would have felt the same way.
Yeah, which is why the reader can put themselves there. The readers can be there with you.
I hope.
So the future of nonfiction storytelling, because you're committed to storytelling, obviously, and the AIDS story is something you probably took a step back and look at the landscape and say, this is important, or it's going to be important to the readers at some point, and you went ahead and did it. But what can you tell our editors and reporters just in terms of the importance of storytelling? It seems like, and I'm going to read you one more thing if you don't mind. And this is pretty powerful because this is from 1989 from the Pioneer Press Dispatch. And it could have been a standard spot news under deadline filing. But here's how you start. Dad was dead and Mom was trapped in the truck with the Christmas presents. That's a courageous opening, especially in a small town where we have to deal with people. We can see the effects of our words. And I say we because I still write. So what can you tell us about that in terms of elevating it to a story as opposed to a dispatch in this case, or storytelling?
Right. A few things. One is there are all kinds of ways to tell stories, right? So this is not about platform. This is not about text versus photo versus, you know, audio. I think you need to know that there is a difference between story and article. So I could have written that car crash story that you just read the top of as an article. 5 paragraphs, AP, you know, guy's dead and his wife and children are in a hospital after, blah, blah, blah. A narrative, a story, takes us into another world, or a world that we share emotionally. And so you need to kind of know the difference, and they merge, you know, they overlap in journalism. They have to overlap because we do nonfiction, but you have to know the difference, and you have to know that there is a difference between an article and a story. I think you need to have an eye out for when story actually works and makes sense, as opposed to when it's just self-indulgent. A lot of people, when they start out wanting to do storytelling or narrative, are pretty self-indulgent. I think you need to know what a friend of mine calls the physics of storytelling, which is that, and it seems counterintuitive, but it's that the more individual and the more intimate, the more universal. So Dad was dead and Mom was trapped in the truck is incredibly intimate. I wanted to tell that story through the point of view of the kids. I wanted you to know that there were these two kids who had to basically save themselves and their mother after seeing their father killed. Well, that's very intimate and very individual, but it's also universal because we've all been kids. We've all worried about losing our parents, or we all are parents who are worried about what would happen if our kids went through this. So that's what makes it universal. And then I think we have to recognize that stories are journeys at some point. So AIDS in the Heartland is a journey, two men going through diagnosis to death from AIDS. That story up the mountains in Iraq is a journey of me walking up that mountain and then greeting these people who are coming over the mountains from their homeland to they don't know what. The story of the car crash is the journey of these two kids who have to figure out how to save themselves and their mother. And that's all embedded in everything we know about the stories we've been reading since the time we were kids and are reading, you know, fairy tales. They're all journeys. At some point, they're journeys. And they're all individual, but they're all universal.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be doing them, Mike, all the time. That's the self-indulgent part. We shouldn't be turning everything we do into a story, but we should constantly be looking for the opportunity.
Right. And that's whether we're in a city or in a small town.
Always. Oh, yeah. You bet. As a matter of fact, I actually think small towns in some ways lend themselves better to stories because we're closer to them. We're closer to them. We're going to the grocery store and the gas station and, you know, we're going to the same place that the people we're writing about and for are going. So we're part of that journey.
Right. And I always think of the, you know, the phrase, the shock of the familiar, especially in a small town, which a newspaper can deliver. And I remember seeing a series elsewhere on the history of a building, and not just the nuts and bolts of the history of the building. It was architecturally interesting, but the people who live there through the generations, or the people that work there. And had their photos and their stories. You couldn't drive by that building without thinking of those faces from the 1920s, for instance.
Right. And again, that's a classic archetype. You know, if these walls could talk.
Right.
So imagine any building that people have lived in or worked in or been part of, and it's got stories to tell.
Yeah.
And we all live in place, right? And those places, they mark us and we mark them.
Right. And along the same vein, and writing profiles, something we all do in our community newspapers.
Right.
And there are hazards to doing that. The tendency is to often put halos on top of people's heads. And I've been fooled before. I've had people call up and say, wait a minute, you missed something.
Yeah.
What would you advise there to avoid hagiography, but deliver the whole person, but you have to make, you're going to see him the next week or the next day or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think you kind of said it really well when you said the whole person. Part of it is when we do a profile, we have to decide what frame the profile fits in. So usually it's not somebody's whole life. Oh, but it's somebody's whole life. And, you know, if there's something really, really big, let's say you just hired a new police chief in your community or something. You want to know about his whole career. But usually when we profile people, the frame is tighter and smaller, and we want to stay in that frame.
Right.
We don't want to be blindsided by things outside that frame that make what's in that frame problematic. But I don't think we need to trot out, you know, something that happened 40 years ago. I mean, God forbid if somebody wrote about me and stupid things I did 40 years ago. So I think we need to figure out our frame. We need to figure out the purpose of the profile. And then we need to recognize that, again, another friend of mine, really, really great writer, calls it including the bruise on the apple.
Yeah.
So there's the apple and we polish the apple and we write what we think are profiles. But, you know, apples have bruises. And by including those bruises, it makes people more real. And if it's in context, they might not like it immediately. So when I did the AIDS piece, the guys didn't like what I wrote right away. Matter of fact, they hated it. But it was in context, and I could explain to them that if I left that out, nobody would believe them. Nobody would take them seriously, that they were human beings and all human beings are flawed. And we have to include the relevant flaws, the relevant bruises, so people are credible. And if it's in context, as opposed to, you know, you put a spotlight on the sensational or the negative stuff, then I think most people are okay with it. But that's where I get back to, you know, what I said at the beginning, when you say, how do you get people to trust you? We don't explain ourselves well to the people that we're interviewing or writing about, and we need to. We need to say, this is why I want to know this. This is why I want to write about it. We can talk about how I write about it, but this is why I think it needs to be in the story.
Hold
and then
the
it
story.
Needs to be part of a conversation. Yeah.
And when you're doing a profile, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of my own experience too, but I'm less interested in what year they graduated from high school than
right
what they were thinking about themselves. And mm-hmm. often I found myself in territory where I'm asking questions they've never asked themselves, and mm-hmm. you see the layers peel away, and they're mm-hmm. actually thinking and doing a deep dive into their own psyche.
Right.
It goes from an interview to a conversation. And that's sort of where you want to be, I think, if you're going to do a profile.
Yes, as long as you remember that the conversation has a professional purpose.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And the professional purpose is to tell a story that is shared with the public.
Right.
And it's not to protect the relationship.
Yes.
So a true conversation, like between two friends, your goal is to protect the relationship, right? It's to build a relationship.
Right.
And the goal is to say, I want this relationship to continue as a friendship or whatever. Or if I'm talking to my doctor, I might be having a conversation, but the goal of that conversation is to give her information so she can help me make better decisions about my health. If you're doing a journalistic interview or conversation, you have to, again, be very clear with people that the goal of that conversation is to find out their authentic experience, their authentic viewpoint, and then make decisions about what part of that you want to share with the public, because it has value to the public.
Right. And have you ever found yourself in the position where you think, I know the story they're in and they don't?
Oh, interesting. Sure. I think anytime you're dealing with people who are somewhat traumatized or really stuck in the moment because it's so big, that happens. So I was at the Olympics twice. I did the Olympics in 88 and in 92. And at the end of the Olympics, they always have they have a victory party. They have this big winner's party. Everybody goes. Because in the Olympics, everything's like divided off, right? And you can't get access, and you can't get this, and you can't get this. And then they're over, and everybody goes to the same big party, and they drink, and they have a good time. Well, I was going to go to that, and I was asking around to the Minnesota local folks, because that's who I was covering, if I could see them at the party. Because you finally have access to these athletes you've never had access to. And one of the guys just said, I'm not going. I said, why not? And he said, because I'm a loser. I was like, what? And he says, yeah. I said, well, what are you going to do? And he says, well, I'm going to the loser's party. And sure enough, there was this small group of people from the Olympics athletes who ended up sitting in like this little room watching TV, and they all considered themselves losers. And I went, because that was so much more interesting than going to the winner's party, right?
Of course.
And it was fascinating. And this guy was a boxer, and he came in seventh in the Olympics, and he considered himself a loser. And he was astute or plugged in enough to know that the reason he felt that way was because his entire family had sacrificed all his life so he could get to this point. And he felt he let them down.
Yeah.
I'm watching this entire room of people who don't understand that they are among the elite of the world because of one little moment where something went wrong or they weren't quite good enough. They didn't get that. They had no perspective at the time. And I think a lot of the stories we do, we have to recognize, and we should recognize in our own lives too, we don't have any perspective at the time. We can't. And so one of the things you try to bring to this work is a little bit of outside perspective, and that should inform your questions, but it should also inform your compassion, and it should inform then how you decide and whether you decide to tell that that story to the rest of the world.
Right. And part of that, you emphasize listening. And I think you've remarked that your concern about listening skills have possibly been diminished by social media and other things. Can you just talk a little bit about that in terms of the differences, degrees of listening?
Well, when I'm on email, and I think I'm pretty good on email because I use it all the time. I think most of us are getting better, but there's no way to I can try to figure out or kind of extrapolate or infer the 80% of communication that's not happening in an email, because so much of communication is tone of voice and, you know, facial expression and all that. But I can't be sure I'm getting it right. Part of it is that I think because we're so plugged in, you know, I watch young people and they always have their earbuds in their heads.
Yeah.
Or they're always on their phones. Have they really learned to sit and be quiet while somebody talks, to give them time? As journalists, I think one of the key things we need to realize is that we ask a question, somebody answers it, we write down the answer, and we move on to the next question. They might not have said what they really needed to say yet. They may not have said what they really meant. So just sitting there and being present and waiting for people to sort of sort themselves out and asking the same question over and over. What do you mean by that? Give me an example. Tell me about a time. That's all about listening and really being, listening is about patience. It's really about kind of saying, I'll sit here until you know that you've said what you wanted to say.
Yeah.
And then pushing when they're evading you, but also giving them room and space to go to a place they might not. So when you said that, you know, you've talked to people and they tell you things and you've asked questions that they've never heard and they go to a place they never have, it's because, I assume it's because you're giving them the space to do that. And then you're giving them the gift of listening to what they actually have to say and respecting it. You don't have to agree with it. You don't have to like it, but you have to respect it. So I worry a little bit about, actually I worry a lot about whether or not we've lost that ability in society with the noise, all the white noise of the internet and earbuds and this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, I don't know.
And you talk
where we are.
You talk about also don't presume, which is part of that. I mean, don't
cut
somebody off with your presumption.
Right. When you do overseas reporting or parachute reporting, and I was never an overseas reporter I was never stationed overseas for 2 or 3 years. I would have loved to have been, but that didn't work out. You either bring your Western narrative with you and impose it on everybody, or you get there and you realize you don't know shit. You just don't know shit. You think you do, but you don't.
Yeah.
And then you have to stop and say, oh, well, then I have to start over. And I have to figure out that if I don't know anything, what do I need to know and how do I find it out? And so presuming that you know anybody else's experience or anybody else's life is really dangerous. And it's also very human. We do it in our personal relationships all the time. I'm terrible at it in my personal relationship. But if you're reporting, I think you need to go into situations, especially if you're doing this kind of work, where you're like, I don't know your experience. Can you help me understand it? And then you need to sit there. And sometimes you can use your assumptions, presumptions to help move the interview along, to say, I would imagine this feels like X, does it? Then they'll push back, or they'll like, well, yeah, kinda. Or you just need to say, I have no idea how this feels. I interviewed a guy once who lost his wife and daughter in a pipeline explosion, natural gas pipeline explosion. he and his one daughter went out the back door, were safe. He and his wife, and the other daughter went out the front door and ran into a fireball, were killed. And I ended up with the first interview with him about a week later. And I said to him at the time, not easy, but I said, you know, I don't have kids. That never happened for me. I have no idea, except intellectually, what it's like to lose one. Can you help me understand that? I could have said, oh, I know it's the hardest thing in the world to lose a child. Well, that's my presumption. I don't know if that's true. No. And it wouldn't have gotten anything for my story other than him saying, yes, it is. Doesn't do me any good for my story. Right. But if I just said, I don't know anything about this, help me, he might then start to be willing to help me.
Yeah. Let me ask you something very basic at this point, Jackie. Mm-hmm. When a reporter or an editor has to call up someone who's suffered a family tragedy, how do you approach that? What do you say initially?
Well, the first thing is you have to acknowledge you just don't want to do it. You just don't want to do it. And you have to find out, I think, if there are other ways to approach that person. Is there a family member, an intermediary, whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you really do have to just call the person directly, I think you have to say, I'm really, really sorry to be bothering you. Here's what I'm doing. Here's why. Are you willing to spend 5 minutes with me helping me understand what happened? If they say no, then I think you need to back up a little bit and say, okay, I understand. Is there anyone else I could talk to?
Mm-hmm.
And if they still say no, then I think you need to say, can I call you back in a few hours or a few days?
Yeah.
And if they hesitate at all in there, and this is the part that non-journalists don't like about us, if there's even a little doorway, I think you need to jump through it and say, let me tell you why I think it's important for you to talk. It is completely your choice, but then you have to be willing to tell them why it might help if they did talk and help, you know, society and help the bigger story and help government decisions and all that. So you have to be very respectful of them, but also very aware that you need to take every appropriate opportunity to help them understand why in that moment it might be good to talk.
So if we could,
we take no for an answer way too quickly. Sure. Way too quickly.
If we could just, again, stay on the basics here. I'm just thinking about, as you say, acknowledging up front that it's not a story. This is not a call I want to make. This is not a story I want to do if right. you're doing it. But when you tell somebody who suffered a tragedy why mm-hmm. it's important, what verbiage do you use? What reasons do you give why this matters that we talk?
It depends on the situation. If it's a case, so like the father who lost his wife and child in a pipeline explosion, that was a big lawsuit. It was going to be a big lawsuit. It had to do with government, failed government oversight with the company that ran the pipeline not being honest or, you know, about its checks and monitoring. And it had to do with a guy who lost a daughter and wife. And so part of what I said to him was, this is going to continue to be part of the news. You're going to continue to be asked about it. If you talk to me now, perhaps that can be your statement. But there will be a necessity for you to speak, whether you want to or not. I want to give you an opportunity to do that now on your terms. When I called the mother about the two kids, you know, in that little car crash story, I said to her, which was very honest, I said, we write a little 5-paragraph piece about every fatality that happens, car crash, you know, traffic fatality, and we do maybe 350 or 400 a year, and they're 5 paragraphs and people move on. And I happen to know that the hole in your life is not just 5 paragraphs, it's huge. would you be willing to talk to me about this so people understand the cost of something as simple as, you know, a fatal car crash?
Right.
Because it's not in your life. Yeah. So you're not trying to manipulate them, but you're trying to pay attention to what is it, how can you think about where they might be standing and say, what would be of use or value to you? Sometimes it's letting them know that, you know, with the AIDS story, I talked to everybody in Dick's family. They didn't want to talk to me. They did not want to talk to me. But I convinced them all to talk because they said, if you don't talk, then he gets to own the entire story. And your story is reflective of 90% of America, maybe 95%.
Yeah.
Don't you want your chance to have a say? Sometimes it's because people want to correct the record because nobody's really gotten it right until now. With the losers at the Olympics, I told these guys, I said, look, everybody thinks everybody at the Olympics is a hero and you don't feel that way. Let's talk about why and what do you do with that going forward?
Right.
So you're just, I think the key is to be really honest and also really think about why you think the story has value, as opposed to just because my editor wants me to file it on deadline.
Right.
It's like, well, no, why should we be doing this story? What bigger purpose might it serve?
Right. Okay. So we have about 10 minutes. There are a couple of things more I want to cover.
Okay.
And one is, again, the future of nonfiction storytelling. And mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of the travails the media is going through and has gone through economically, and then the assaults on the media from politicians. Mm-hmm. And one of our previous guests was a fellow named Les Zeitz, who was a two-time. Mm-hmm. Do you know Les?
Yeah, I know Les. Yeah, we go way back.
Yeah, two-time Pulitzer finalist as the Oregonian who bought the Malheur Enterprise.
Right. And
thinking that he'd kick back and teach a couple of reporters the business and he'd tend to his cattle. And of course, he's been working hard, breaking stories right and left. And he's in a community that is thoroughly red. It was over 70% for Trump in the last election. And his online and newsprint subscriptions have gone way up. Way up. They've taken, I don't know the numbers at hand, but they've taken a vertical leap. And it's basically he's doing the kinds of stories that people can see for themselves pan out, and they can see the results. So I'm just thinking there's one example of storytelling and reporting that makes a difference that people can see for themselves, no matter their political persuasion. But the importance, what should the future of storytelling be in the environment we find ourselves in?
Well, you know, the business part of it is something I'm not smart enough or stupid enough to take on. I think there are layers of this. So when the newsrooms contracted, most of them, they went back to, and I think this is a smart decision. They contracted and went back to basic civic coverage.
Yeah.
Covering local government, what's going on in your community, informational stuff, and then investigative stuff. That's where Les has really, you know, climbed the mountain and stood on the top and said, you know, I'm going to be fearless in this community. People love to be pissed off, right? And they love to be righteous. And so Les is out there, you know, saying, I'm not going to fold, and I'm not going to like pull punches, and I'm not going to shade things. And so he's exposing things that whether or not you agree with what's going on, you want to know about it. So you can pretty much have an opinion. Civic coverage, I think, is really important because fewer and fewer people are doing it. I think what's going on with the coronavirus is a good example, but it's not like super exciting. So then you have to decide if you want to plant your flag that way. And then I think you need to get out in the community and let them know why what you're doing has value, that and that nobody else is doing it, including their government.
Right.
So then I think that becomes a marketing push out effort that we've not been very good at. Storytelling in the narrative sense is harder to defend and justify because there's no direct you're not, you can't say, well, you deserve to know this because your city council did this and you need to understand this, or these people were like abusing your taxes or whatever. Years ago, when we first started doing all this clickbait stuff, I remember saying to someone, there are no metrics that measure the impact of the human heart. And we can't, I don't think we can know whether or not that kind of storytelling pays the bills or makes a difference. I know I believe in it personally, but I don't know what its future is. I think it's showing up in narrative podcasts. I think the fact that books are selling more than they ever have, that Netflix is like, the stock market's crashing and Netflix is doing great. Thank you very much. People really want stories. And I think if we can figure out how to tell stories in their own community that help them relate to that community, I think that has enormous value. I don't know if we're going to get paid for it. I just don't.
Yeah.
I just know we know how to do it.
Yeah. So can you just talk a little bit about your website? Because I find it amazing. There is detailed advice for editors and writers, and I mean, all the dance steps.
Don't come on my website. Mike, I haven't touched it for 4 years.
Well, it's pretty good. That's okay, because the basics
are talking about my personal website?
Yeah, with all your advice for writers and editors, the 7 paths and 8th way to.
I literally have. I should go back to it, and like I need to do something with that thing. Now that all my work gigs are canceling because of the coronavirus, maybe I can do that.
Well, let me tell our listeners out there that the website is very rich in detailed advice for writing and writing a good story, and also examining your own story. You put people through the paces. Here's what you need to do with your own writing to make sure it passes muster. And it was pretty intimidating, I must say. I thought I knew all the dance steps. It's sort of like ballroom dancing without knowing the dance steps. But I mean, it's good stuff. So the website is, I'm going to spell it out. It's JackieBanaczynski.com, JackieBanaczynski.com, right?
Yep.
I would really recommend that our editors and reporters spend some time there, because it would.
Well, thank you, because I need a nudge to get back into that thing and like update it.
There you go.
I also would encourage your your audience to check out Neiman Storyboard.
Yeah.
NeimanStoryboard.org, which, you know, has just a the search function is not good, but it's got just an amazing array of stuff.
Okay. Yeah. So one last question. When should we look for your memoirs?
I wouldn't hold your breath.
By the way.
I wouldn't hold your breath.
I will.
It's not likely.
Okay.
Not likely.
All right. Well, thank you for being with us, Jackie.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. You made it fun.
That concludes our podcast. As is always the case at WNPA, we welcome your ideas, comments, and criticisms. Our contact information can be found online at WNPA.com.